Sooner or later, scientists will have to realize that everything they know about the outside world is filtered through the limitations of the instrument through which they perceive it. Well, what is the instrument through which we perceive the world? The finite mind. So until we know the nature of the mind with which the world is known, we cannot know anything for certain about that world. We cannot be sure, for instance, that the limitations that we attribute to the world are not part of the perceiving faculty. If we were to remove the perceiving faculty, namely the mind, what would remain of the world? We don't know, because we can't. The only way we can perceive the world is through the mind. So we might conclude from this that it is not possible to know the nature of the world. That would be true except for one fact, that we emanate from the world. We are part of the world. And we do have direct, immediate access to ourselves. When I say immediate, I mean knowledge of ourselves that is not mediated through the finite mind. So the only element of the world that we can know, the thing in itself, as Kant called it, is the knowledge of ourself. And sooner or later, scientists must realize this. So just one thing to add. That, of course, if we investigate the nature of ourself, we arrive at consciousness. So is this what... not sure that it was Einstein. Who was it that said that consciousness is fundamental? I thought it was Schrödinger. Anyway, whoever it was, it's not quite enough to say that consciousness is fundamental, because panpsychists also believe that consciousness is fundamental. Panpsychism, from pan meaning everything and psyche meaning mind or consciousness, panpsychist, which is the kind of cutting edge of contemporary science's view of consciousness now, is panpsychism, namely the belief that everything has at least a degree of consciousness. So even the smallest particles have a modicum of consciousness. In other words, everything, every object, including the smallest subatomic particles, are conscious. Panpsychism, everything is conscious. So this is the extent to which not really scientists, but philosophers, scientists and philosophers of mind, have incorporated consciousness in their model of the reality. But it's a mistake. And the reason they've made a mistake is that they've started with their matter model. That's the model they start with. And then they realize that consciousness is this awkward phenomenon that is not cannot be accounted for under the conventional materialist model. So to accommodate consciousness in their model, they've stuck with the materialist model and added consciousness to it. And this is their way of accommodating the inconvenient fact of consciousness, the reality of consciousness, without giving up their materialist presumptions. But it's a mistake. You have to give up the matter model. You have to start from scratch, not start from the matter model and add consciousness to it. You have to start from scratch. You have to start with a fundamental element of our experience, which is consciousness. And consciousness is the only element of our experience. All that anybody has ever known, does ever know, or could ever know, is the knowing of experience. So consciousness is in fact all that is ever known. So why build a model of reality that starts with matter, which is an abstract category of experience that is supposed to exist outside consciousness, that nobody has ever found or could ever find, and then try to derive consciousness from matter? We're trying to derive the only thing that is ever truly known, consciousness, from that which is never known. It's madness. Look around at the world. Look at the state of the world. Look at the state of our society. Could it be that the state of disintegration and chaos that our society is in, and our relationship with nature, could it have something to do with our fundamental attitude towards reality? Well, of course it is. It is a reflection of that attitude. So, whilst the understanding consciousness is fundamental, is of course a big step forward for a physicist to come out and say that, it's not enough. It's not what we speak of here. Because it can be interpreted in different ways. We also believe that consciousness is fundamental, but it's possible to believe that consciousness is fundamental and be a panpsychist. So we have to be clearer in our formulation. We have to define what we mean when we say consciousness is fundamental. Here we mean in philosophical terms, consciousness is the ontological primitive. It is the primary element of reality from which everything else is derived.
Can you come to this understanding from just the outward facing path without going through the inward facing path first?
That's a good question. I don't think you can, no. No, because if we embark on the outward-facing path, by the outward-facing path, for those of you that are not familiar with the term, I mean the path in which we turn towards objects, inward-facing path is the path in which we turn towards the subject, ourself. So you turn towards objects with the intention of discovering the nature of reality. No, sooner or later you go on and on and on and on and on, and you have to, at some stage, it comes full circle. You have to, at some stage, question the nature of the mind with which these objects are known. Our knowledge of objects can only be as good as our knowledge of the mind with which they are known. And in fact, our knowledge of objects appears in accordance with our belief in the nature of the knower. If we believe that the nature of the knower is limited, then our knowledge of objects, that is, our knowledge of the world, will appear in accordance with that belief. We will think that the world is a multiplicity and diversity of limited, discrete, independently existing objects. But if we understand that the nature of the knower is infinite, then our knowledge of the world will correspond to that. We will understand that the nature of what we essentially are, namely infinite consciousness, is the same as the nature of the world. So no, I think eventually the outward-facing path must lead back to...
My question is, I had done yoga meditation that you had online that got me very agitated while I was doing it, and I stuck with it because you had said in another teaching, sometimes agitation is a good sign, so I stuck with it. I would say about several months later, I wouldn't say this is the cause of it, but for some reason I feel like it was the cause of it, or at least the whatever the output was. I'm seeing things now more in a softer sense, even when we did the yoga today and you were asking us to feel our sensations. So the solidity of objects are sort of dissipating, if you will. But in the process of that happening, things are becoming less nounish and more like a verb. And you've touched on this somewhat in your book, but I felt like it was something that you noted about the use of vocabulary to attribute to describe things. And now I'm feeling, I don't know if it's unease or just I feel like everything's in motion.
Yes.
All the time. And even things that I used to enjoy doing, like reading an op-ed piece in a newspaper, you know, to capture what had just happened the day before, I'm finding it's not even accurate when I guess I am being dismissive of it. Things that I used to enjoy doing, I'm not enjoying anymore because I don't feel like they're actually capturing the reality that I'm seeing anymore. And that's kind of where I just wanted to know if you could talk about that a little bit.
Okay. You're right about the difference between nouns and verbs. Normally we think that when we look out into the world, we see nouns. We see people, mats, chairs, floors, cameras, windows, lights. These are things, these are objects. That's what Jane sees when she walks around Paris. She sees cars and houses and buses and people and trees. She sees objects, she sees nouns. When Mary wakes up, she looks back on the dream, she realizes, no, there were no objects there. There were no selves there. It was all the activity of my mind. It was a verb, not a noun. So what appears to be objects and selves from a multiplicity and diversity of objects and selves from Jane's point of view turns out to be the activity of Mary's mind. The streets of Paris are what the activity of Mary's mind looks like from Jane's localized point of view. So I would suggest that the agitation you felt when you were doing the yoga meditations was because you were experiencing this before your mind had the correct interpretation for it. And as a result, your familiar sense, not only of yourself as the body, but also your familiar sense of the world, was beginning to fall apart. As nature said, everything vanishes, falls apart, doesn't it? You were experiencing this viscerally before you had understood it. And the ego, or the apparently separate self, invests itself in the objects of experience, particularly the body, but in everything else. So when you began to feel the apparently solidity of everything beginning to soften and turn into a flux, what was really threatened was your ego, because the things, the objects in which it previously invested itself were beginning to disintegrate, and the ego cannot stand on its own. It has to stand in identification with something. When the ego is divested of everything it identifies with, it stands revealed as pure consciousness. So this agitation was the fear of the ego. But it was not intellectual for you. There was this visceral feeling, I'm going to die. And it was very good that you stuck with it, because it's a good experience. It's difficult. Maybe a bit of a surprise. You think you're going to sit down, meditate, and experience peace, and you suddenly feel all this fear of death. But it's a good experience because the ego, the felt sense of separation, was being exposed. Previously, you were probably not even aware of it, but now it was exposed, and it was good that it was exposed at an experiential level, not just an intellectual level. So your mind is now catching up with what happened. And it's good that your mind catches up. It's good that you reinterpret your experience, because this will give you the confidence when this next, if indeed it does start happening again, to stay with it rather than thinking, oh, this is uncomfortable, I'm not doing it right. No, it's good. And now that you have the correct well, even before you had the correct interpretation, you had the courage to stick with it, which was good. But now you have the interpretation. So if you feel this discomfort again, turn towards it. Don't turn away from it.
Just one follow-up to that is, I'm finding it more... I'm probably saying this in the wrong way, but my meditation when my eyes are open is a little bit more... is a little easier now. And when I close my eyes, I'm finding... it used to be a little easier for me to relax into myself, but now I'm finding it that I want my eyes open and be aware. Like, I don't know if I'm deluding myself into thinking. I feel more awareness when my eyes are open when I meditate.
Yes, sometimes when our eyes are closed, it's easier to get lost in thought because there's nothing to give our attention to externally. The ego, as I said, needs something to direct itself towards, otherwise it cannot stand. So if there's nothing to be interested in the world when our eyes are closed, it will manufacture a daydream in order to keep it, in order to substantiate itself. So, so yes, if that's the case, you open your eyes, thinking tends to diminish and perceiving tends to increase. And if you find that easier, then that's fine. Just meditate with your eyes open. Really, it makes absolutely no difference whether your eyes are open or closed, whether you're meditating, because if your eyes are closed, your experience is thoughts, sensations, and perceptions. They all arise in consciousness. They are known by consciousness. Ultimately, they are made of consciousness. With your eyes open, your experience is perceptions. Perceptions arise in consciousness. They're known by consciousness. And they are made of consciousness. So really, in time, the distinction between eyes open and eyes closed, it diminishes. We only meditate with our eyes closed in the early stages of this investigation because for most of us, the world is so colorful and fascinating. So it's just a way, initially, of removing the larger part of our objective experience and giving us the best chance of going back to the presence of awareness. But in time, it's no longer necessary to do that. And you can meditate equally sitting silently here with your eyes closed on a cushion or walking down the high street.
This realization before, but I'm having it now too. So if I distill the knowing to just the sense of being and just that, it's literally the same exact sense that every other living creature would have as well.
Exactly. Yes, if just to make the point a little explicit in a little slightly more dramatic way, let's say we had the two people, let's say yourself, go to another extreme, let's take Hitler. And we were to ask both of you to describe your thoughts and your feelings. They would be poles apart. But if we were to ask both of you, turn your attention away from your thoughts and feelings, just to the pure sense, I am, your experience would be identical.
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 Like my son.
You would actually be experiencing, I'm not suggesting that you would be experiencing pure being over there, and he would be experiencing pure, you'd be experiencing the same being.
Yes. And when I looked at my son that way, it was like I saw that he wasn't, you know, he was me. This might not be the right way to say it, but the love he has, the love I have for myself that manifests in my desire to survive one way or the other. So it's always, whatever I do, it's always, as you say, for my happiness in the end. even if it seems selfless, it's always because of the love I have for myself. That's the same exact love that he has for himself, or every single creature has for itself. Exactly. It's that sense of being, and it's like mind-blowing.
Yes, you're absolutely right. The reason we wish happiness for ourselves is because we love ourselves, not our personal self. We love the self above all else. And that's why, as an inevitable consequence of this understanding, because we want happiness for ourselves, because we love ourselves above all else, we want happiness for everyone, because we love everyone's self as ourself.
Well, then I wasn't really here in this body anymore, because I was, but I wasn't. The body was in space, because being is everywhere. That's what.
Yes, yes. That's why when we turn the news on and we see the image of a child suffering on the other side of the world, it breaks our heart.
Yes.
Because we want that child to be happy, for exactly the same reason that we want ourselves to be happy. Because we feel that the self of that child is ourself. And just as it breaks our heart to be unhappy, it breaks our heart to see somebody else that is unhappy.
But this realization is more than just empathy in the sense of what I used to feel, empathy.
Well,
this is literally like...
This is real empathy.
I am the other.
Yeah, empathy... It can mean two things. It can be sympathizing with somebody else's feelings or sympathizing with their being.
Yes.
Real empathy is sympathizing with their being, knowing yourself as their self, and as a result of that, feeling their feelings as if they were your own, which makes you want to cry with them when they are sad. But you don't just feel their sadness as your own, you feel their joy as your own. So you cry with them when they're sad, and you laugh with them when they're happy.
Can I ask then, so this sense of being, if I'm standing at that, I don't know, gate in a sense, just here, is that an experience that also comes and goes? Because, like, I had this fear of being without knowing that I am.
No, it's not an experience that comes and goes. It is concealed and revealed, but it remains ever present. The screen is always there, sometimes concealed by the movie, sometimes shining as the movie, and sometimes in the absence of the movie, but always the screen. Being, God's being, that which truly is always present, sometimes concealing itself with names and forms, sometimes revealing itself as love.
I mean, everything is on. It's on, it's illuminated, right?
Yes.
But if there was no object, then I would be an infinite sun with nothing outside.
Yes, that's how it is from consciousness's point of view.
And that's fine, right? I mean, because you are that which is, you are the light. You don't have to have an object.
Yes, we are apparent localizations of that, apparent and temporary localizations of that one infinite light or love or whatever you call it.